It's Thursday, November 21st. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your look at news from around the state. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Today on the show, we explore the secrets of a painted rock on the side of the highway between Fort Collins and Laramie, Wyoming.
But first, New Belgium Brewing Company first started in the basement of a Fort Collins home in the early 90s. Since then, it has grown to become the fourth largest craft brewery in the U.S. Earlier this week, we learned that the employee-owned brewing company has been sold to Lion Little World Beverages, a multinational beverage company. Erin Udell has been covering the story for the Coloradoan and joins us now with more. Hi, Erin.
Hi, Erin.
We don't currently know how much New Belgium was purchased for. What, if anything, do we know about the deal?
So what we do know right now is what New Belgium told us Tuesday morning, and that's that Lion Little World Beverages will acquire 100% of the brewery in an all-cash transaction that's set to be finalized by the end of this year. What that means for New Belgium now is that if this does go through, it will no longer be employee-owned. It's been partially employee-owned since 2000, fully employee-owned since 2012. So that's obviously a big change.
And I want to talk more about that. But before we get to that point, what do we know about Lion Little World Beverages, the company that's acquiring New Belgium?
Little World Beverages is the global craft arm of Lion, which is an Australian beverage and food company. So together, they're Lion Little World Beverages. But Lion is actually a subsidiary of Japanese beverage conglomerate Kirin. Basically, New Belgium, this Fort Collins owned homegrown brewery, if the sale goes through, would become a property of a global beverage conglomerate, which has ties in Australia, New Zealand, and ultimately Japan.
And you spoke with Kim Jordan, who co-founded New Belgium in 1991. What did she say about the decision to sell?
She kind of ran me through more of the timeline of these acquisition talks. So she said that serious talks started this summer. And she said their board of directors first traveled out to Fort Collins to meet with New Belgium's board of directors and management team in fall. And she said something to the effect of, you know, they had an outside dinner and there was just that fall air and they were just kind of riffing and talking about what New Belgium is all about, what Lion Little World is all about. And she said it kind of just clicked. And I know that she mentioned kind of their commitment to craft brewing really intrigued her, that they themselves, that Little World Beverages has committed to going carbon neutral in 2020. Intrigued her since New Belgium is a sustainable company itself.
So all of those things in that dinner conversation factored into Kim Jordan's ultimate decision to sell?
You know, that's what she told me. That's kind of that moment that she said things flipped that dinner and they kind of were talking about these, what was important to them. It sounds like they just have the two companies, New Belgium and Lion Little World, have largely shared values.
New Belgium was employee owned prior to the sale. How did that model factor into the decision? I mean, did employees have any say in that decision?
Technically, the decision to sell has not been made yet. So, you know, New Belgium's obviously announced that they're moving towards a sale, but their employee ownership does kind of go into that final decision. So in 2000, New Belgium went partially employee-owned. I believe Kim Jordan and her family maintained 41%, so a controlling stake. It went 100% employee-owned in 2012. So one of the kind of last things to do in this deal would be, it's kind of pending approvals by some regulators and New Belgium's employee stock ownership plan members. So it's employee owners, essentially. So I was told that there will be a vote of those employee stock ownership plan members on this potential sale.
With the understanding that this isn't a done deal, so to speak, but is there any word on potential job cuts or any other kind of restructuring?
There's no word on exactly what that could look like if it does happen. But what I've been told by New Belgium CEO is that it's kind of business as usual right now. New Belgium at the moment doesn't anticipate any changes with his employees or beers, its distribution in Fort Collins. So that's what I've been told. But obviously, we at the Coloradoan will be following along just in case there are changes.
Erin Udell is a reporter for the Coloradoan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, of course.
We've been hearing a lot about impeachment this week from Washington, D.C., with the hearings going on. And we wanted to look at how people here in Northern Colorado are talking about this issue. One person who is discussing impeachment in the classroom is Matthew Hitt. He's an assistant professor of political science at Colorado State University. He's teaching a class about legislative politics and is on the line with us right now. Matthew, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you for having me.
So when did you decide you were going to talk about impeachment to your class? Was this something that was already part of your curriculum?
We were going to talk about the relationship between Congress and the president, but it was when Nancy Pelosi announced the beginning of the impeachment inquiry that I really said to myself, you know, we've got to actually take this head on. This is a class that primarily focuses on Congress, what Congress is doing for the fourth impeachment in American history. This is very much our lane. So if we can't talk about it and give it some historical and social scientific context, then what are we doing here?
How are you going about teaching this?
So one of the things I'm very aware of, and I try so hard to be respectful of, is the broad diversity of political viewpoints I have sitting out there in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So I recognize some people are very threatened and upset about impeachment. Some people are jazzed, if uncertain about impeachment. I think a lot of my students maybe don't know quite what to think about impeachment. Mm-hmm. So what I strive to do is talk about where impeachment has generated from historically. One of the things we spend a lot of time on is Alexander Hamilton's writings about what a high crime and misdemeanor is, what that phrase meant to the folks who were putting the impeachment clause into the Constitution, right? What did that actually mean? What constitutes impeachability? And to what extent does what's going on now fit or not fit that? And we rely on some work from some really excellent contemporary political scientists thinking about, okay, what are the factors in previous impeachments and how does this current Ukrainian affair line up with that in terms of its severity?
What have you been hearing from your students about it? I mean, are they engaged with the topic? Are they into it?
I think they are. You know, I start every class with a short 5 to 10 minutes of today in legislative politics. And as you would expect, for the last few weeks, impeachment and impeachment hearings are what's going on today in legislative politics. And we tend to have respectful, civil, wide-ranging conversations about what's happening, what it all means. I've heard things that sound like talking points from right and left-wing media. I've heard interesting, thoughtful, historical kinds of questions, just really all over the map, but definitely a lot of engagement and a lot of interest from a terrific group of undergrads in this class.
And, you know, it seems like, in a way, you're setting them up to go home and have thoughtful conversations about politics and about this impeachment process, you know, things that tend to happen over the holidays at the dining room table.
Right. And if any of my students get a turkey leg thrown at them next week, I'm truly sorry. That's not the goal here. I do tell my students with my tongue only half in cheek that as students at a major university studying political science, engaging in a class like legislative politics, they are essentially, at least on an informational level, the political elites in their circle and their networks. And so I expect they will be talking about this with friends, with family members, with people as time goes by. And if I can do anything as a professor, it's to give them some frameworks from our discipline in the social sciences of how can you think about this in a systematic way and not just a responding to every, you know, blip that comes over cable news on the afternoon.
Absolutely. And not getting sucked into the emotion, perhaps.
Absolutely. It can be hard with something as charged as impeachment, but it's definitely the goal is to think about things in a rational and a nuanced way.
Do you have advice for listeners for how you can digest the hours of impeachment hearings and testimony that are coming at us?
If you don't want to spend all morning on C-SPAN watching the stuff in its unedited form, what I often recommend that folks do is if there's some kind of digital platform that they like, I honestly, you know, people might roll their eyes at this. I use Twitter, and the thing, what I follow on Twitter are reporters from some of the same news gathering organizations I just mentioned, as well as the actual political news handles for all these different outlets. And then you can, if you follow sources that you generally trust, that you think generally are doing it the right way, then when you open up something like Twitter, your feed is the headlines from 6 to 10 sources that you trust. And I think that's a really quick way to digest, okay, here's what the news media are talking about today. You know, creating a Twitter account that you never post from, that's just for that purpose. You log in, you see what's going on there, is an incredibly quick way to see what people are talking about. And I strongly prefer that, hearing from multiple sources, looking for points of consensus, as opposed to saying, well, just watch this one news analysis show and that'll pretty much give it to you. Right? I think triangulating across multiple resources is a much better way to do it.
Matthew Hitt is an assistant professor of political science at CSU. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on. It was great talking to you.
Each fall, Colorado State University and the University of Wyoming face off in a football game known as the Border War. But the longtime rivalry between the two schools doesn't just play out on the field. KUNC's Matt Bloom has the story of a local tradition that captures the curiosity of Northern Colorado residents to this day.
Listener Laura Oranowski-Hildebrand recently asked us about a rock north of Fort Collins. Maybe you've heard of it. The 40-ton boulder is called Haystack Rock.
I've only been a Coloradan for a decade, and I really am fascinated by the history.
Oranowski Hildebrand drives by it on her daily commute along Highway 287. What catches her eye are the dozens of colorful paintings on its surface.
And then I begin wondering, you know, who put those messages on there, how they did it, if there was a protocol for when it would change.
Larimer County property records show the land the rock is sitting on is owned by the Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District. That's the region's main water manager.
You got to step between the barbs.
Brian Werner is head of communications there. We met out at Haystack Rock. It's about 60 yards off the road, right beyond this barbed wire fence.
It came down one of those hillsides eons ago and landed here.
We're looking at one face of the rock where there's this scene of the Rocky Mountains along the back with a memorial for somebody painted. There's a cross, a wooden cross with cowboy boots on the ground. And what else?
Cowboy hat, watch over us. So my guess is this is a tribute to somebody in this area that had passed away relatively recently, sometime this year.
There's also a few variations of Go CSU Rams or Go Pokes for the University of Wyoming. New artwork usually pops up right around the time of the annual Border War football game between the two schools.
This is the highway to get between Fort Collins and Laramie. So we go back however many years we've been playing that game with University of Wyoming, and my guess is they probably started soon after that.
Which makes this tradition more than 100 years old. As for the name Haystack Rock, the story goes like this. A farmer in the frontier days decided for fun to cover the rock with hay. A Highland rancher, new to town, showed up to ask if it was for sale.
He said, well, sure it is, and they agreed on a price. This Highland rancher went back, told everybody what a great deal he'd gotten, brought his wagon back to get the hay.
By that time, the farmer was long gone.
This guy had been duped, and it became Haystack Rock.
Depending on who's telling the story, sometimes it's the Union Pacific Railroad or the military being scammed. As far as who does these paintings, Werner couldn't say. And it's not easy to find people who will admit to trespassing on land to paint a rock. After days and many unanswered emails, Nick Korsik reached out on Twitter.
This is a bucket list thing for me to get interviewed by an NPR reporter.
He's 31 and lives in Denver. In the fall of 2006, he was a freshman at the University of Wyoming. And the night before the Border War game, he and a few other people in his dorm decided to paint the rock.
We waited probably till about 10 or 11, make sure it was nice and dark.
They all piled into two cars, made the drive from Laramie, put on some headlamps, and with several cans of spray paint in hand,
in current 18-year-old style, wrote an expletive CSU.
The game was in Wyoming that year, so Korsik and his friends knew that hundreds of Rams fans would drive past Haystack Rock the next day. That included several members of his family.
They were complaining to me about the rude Wyoming people that had painted on the rock, and I just kept my mouth shut because they were going to buy me dinner. So,
why do you think people keep painting on this random rock north of Fort Collins?
It's fun. It's like an easy way to kind of talk trash. Overall, harmless, as I see it. Nobody's getting hurt. There's a lot of people that know each other from both sides. So there's some easy trash talk. It's like, oh, I was the one that painted the rock, that kind of thing.
So there you have it. At least we know some of the answers surrounding the mystery around Haystack Rock. Matt Bloom, KUNC.
since putting that story together, we've had a few exciting updates. We actually found out who painted that cowboy mural with the cross and Rocky Mountains. Matt joins us in the studio now to fill us in. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Henry.
What did you find out?
Well, I called a ton of local businesses, a ton of churches, and asked around to see if anybody knew who painted this beautiful mural, and nobody did. So I waited. After a couple of weeks, I got this kind of cryptic voicemail from a man saying that he could help.
Hello, Matt. You called me a while back about a mural that's on the rock on 287, and I know who that mural was done for, so give me a call back if you'd like.
He used to play poker with this guy named Paul Brabson, who passed away earlier this year. And through some internet sleuthing, I stumbled on some photos that Shelley Robinson had posted of Haystack Rock on Facebook. So I called her up. She's actually the daughter of Paul Brabson. She was a little surprised to hear from me, as you can imagine. We ended up talking about him for about half an hour. She told me that her family went out and painted Haystack Rock in honor of her dad right before his funeral. They were all driving up to the Red Feather Lake area, and that's when her son Alex saw the rock and got this idea.
Alex was like, oh my gosh, you know, I remember passing that all the time to go to Papa's, and what if I paint that so that when people come up, they'll be able to see it, you know, when they come up for the service.
So the day before the service, some of the family went out and painted two sides of the rock together.
People that passed were honking, and, you know, and just knowing that the people were seeing that and recognizing that, you know, Paul, Bill, whoever, but hopefully stopping for a minute and saying a prayer, being thankful for something in their life that they may not have thought of if they wouldn't have seen, you know, something like that painted on the rock.
Robinson said that she was really surprised, actually, that students hadn't painted over it yet. The Border War game is coming up. People could be out there as we speak painting it. But I think it goes to show that there is this sort of unwritten code around this rock. When there's something important on there, like a mural to somebody, you pay your respects to it. You wait at least a little bit longer to paint over it.
That was KUNC's Matt Bloom. And that does it for today's show. Monday on Colorado Edition, we kick off Thanksgiving week with a lesson in high-altitude baking. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer. Our theme music was composed by Colorado musicians Brianna Harris and Johnny Burroughs.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.